enough things have moved that I probably can't reuse too much. I guess the last thing that I did this morning was this load throughput and latency, including the speeds. Ooh, thanks very much. Including the speeds of level 1 cache, level 2 cache, and dynamic RAM, which for most purposes in cryptography you can ignore. But there's a big exception. So let me start here with the question of whether cache misses show up in cryptography. A cache miss is when you try loading something from memory and it's not in level 1 cache. You can think of the normal state of affairs as that all of the memory, all the DRAM that you've recently accessed has been copied into level 1 cache. And then as long as you're just working with those 64 kilobytes of memory, then you only need 2 cycles to access it, to load it from level 1 cache copied into a register. So a lot of people, again, I said registers weren't enough to do a computation, but typically level 1 cache is. Usually a cryptographic computation. Fits quite comfortably into the 64 kilobytes of level 1 cache. 64 KB L1 cache. Some machines have smaller caches as tiny as 16K or even 8K, but, well, computations tend to take 3, 5, 10 kilobytes, and it's unusual for a cryptographic computation, some big integer computation. It's unusual for the integers you're working with to overflow this reasonable size of level 1 cache, or even 16 kilobytes is usually enough. Question? That's a separate, there is an instruction cache that remembers recently used instructions, and there is a slowdown if you go out of the level 1 instruction cache, but that's completely separate from this. The 64 kilobytes here are just for data that's used. Usually you don't have to worry on the UltraSpark about the time to load instructions. You can figure that as quickly as you can throw instructions at the processor, it has all those available. You do have to worry if you have a gigantic program that's jumping around a bunch and has more than whatever amount of, I think it might be a 16 kilobyte or 32 kilobyte level 1 instruction cache on these processors, but I rarely think about it because I normally have loops that fit inside a few kilobytes of code. Maybe a really serious cryptographic function might end up taking some part of the level 1 instruction cache, which along with your network code ends up filling up the instruction cache and you start running out of space there, but it's less of a problem than the data cache, which is generally perceived as not being a problem. If you look at most speed papers, then you see people not worrying about the cache at all. Most high-speed cryptography papers are going to make sure that their data is in level 1 cache before they start timing the software. Most speed papers will measure performance after copying all the data from memory into level 1 cache, which there's no instruction for. Instructions just refer to locations in memory, but by reading, by copying, by loading various spots in memory, you guarantee that at least for the moment they are in level 1 cache. Most speed papers will do that and then start timing how long their computations are taking using that data. So speed papers measure performance after loading data into level 1 cache. And the question that I want to pose here and briefly answer is whether this is reasonable. Are there ever situations in cryptography where we do have to worry about missing the data cache? And then if the answer to that is yes, then are there situations where we have to worry about missing the instruction cache, which I said is less of a problem? The answer to the question is that usually it's reasonable, but there are some pretty important exceptions. For some applications, it's not reasonable to assume that your data can be loaded in just 2 cycles, as opposed to 12 cycles for level 2 cache or 60 cycles for missing all the caches and having to go to DRAM. For some applications, the answer to the question of whether this is reasonable is no. Let me give you an example of a cryptographic function and an important, even though not typical, cryptographic application in which the level 1 cache and level 2 cache misses actually dominate the runtime. I'm going to pick on UMAC here, which has some nice features to it, but one of the things I don't like about it, one of the things that causes serious slowdowns for some applications, is that it has a very big key, which is often described as being expanded from a short key, but the actual UMAC key that you have to refer to in order to do your computations is something like 2048 bytes, depending on exactly which variation of UMAC you use. And now suppose you have some computer that is handling a large number of users. For example, you have an IPsec router. IPsec is the IP Internet Protocol Security Standard, which tells you how to encrypt and authenticate internet packets. It's something that doesn't work across the internet. It doesn't have reasonable mechanisms to manage keys for talking to people you don't know. But it's actually not bad for deploying cryptography within your own network. If you're considering securing your network against attackers, IPsec is a very good first step. If you have a computer that's handling lots of users, imagine a big corporate network with might have as many as 100,000 users inside that network, consider an IPsec router that is talking to all those 100,000 computers, which some IPsec routers, again, this is a kind of corner case of cryptography, but it's something that people do think about at the performance extremes. Consider an IPsec router that's handling 10,000 simultaneous users, 10,000 simultaneous keys. Well, one key fits inside level one cache. And there's an interesting effect that when people are designing different cryptographic functions, they, of course, measure things that fit in level one cache and discard anything that doesn't fit into level one cache with one key. They say, oh, wow, that's really slow. If I have a similar function that for the same reasons UMAC uses 2048 bytes, you might imagine a function using a million bytes of memory, but people immediately throw that away because it just can't fit into level one cache. The performance is always clearly a disaster. So people focus on functions that do fit with one key and never end up timing the same functions with a whole lot of keys. Depending how many keys are active at the same moment, you can get a huge slowdown. And let me point to two situations where you do within this IPsec router handling a lot of simultaneous users, you get a huge cache miss slowdown. The latency of copying data, copying keys from DRAM into level 2 and level 1 cache and then into registers, if you're cycling a bunch between these 10,000 keys. Now, it might happen you have some active users and some computers that are just sitting there, and it's very frequent that your legitimate users are not making you cycle between keys. But if you have a network that's very active with a lot of users, if you imagined what it would be like for a bank authenticating communications across the internet to all of its users, then you could imagine legitimate users cycling between a whole lot of different keys just from typical use with a whole lot of different people. Or the other situation, which is I find more worrisome, is that an attacker cycles between a bunch of keys. So to conclude the sentence here, there's a huge cache miss slowdown if legitimate users or the attacker cycles through a large fraction of these keys. The attacker can decide, hello screensaver, the attacker can decide that he's going to send you a packet or just pass along the legitimate user's packet, reorder the packets from the users, but or he can just, again, forge a packet which says, I'm a packet from user number 37. And then another packet, I'm from user number 3927. And continuing in this way, give you packets which you don't know whether they're legitimate or not until you have loaded the keys and authenticated those packets. And each of those loads involves accessing a lot of those 2048 bytes. Well, to be precise, accessing a lot of lines which end up loading most of that data, producing lots of 60-cycle slowdowns every now and then, well, very frequently, actually. UMAC does quite a few loads, and that happens for every single packet coming in, as opposed to the normal performance of UMAC, which has very few cache miss delays. UMAX slows down quite dramatically if you time it in a setting where you're cycling between a lot of different keys. This doesn't fit anywhere near into level one cache. Okay. In other situations, again, this is a kind of performance extreme. If you're worried about denial of service attacks, attackers who are chewing up your CPU cycles, then you have to think about, hey, what if all of our keys really are accessed? You have to try to fit as many different keys as you can into cache, not just into memory, and not just fitting one key into memory. If, on the other hand, you're using, say, one key at a time, and you just have one user or a few users to deal with, then you're in the situation timed in typical benchmarks of you just have one key that fits into level one cache and you don't have to worry about cache misses. Okay, for the reason of these extreme performance applications, I tend to try to reduce my key sizes, but there's certainly room for functions which don't try to do that. Poly 1305 doesn't have such a long key. As you've seen, at least for one message, it has just a 32-byte key. And when I talk about combining Poly 1305 with stream ciphers, we'll see that the result has a very short key. Okay, so that was cache misses in cryptography. I want to finish off my UltraSpark description by telling you about floating point arithmetic. Before I do that, any questions about cache misses? All right, getting into the serious performance side of the UltraSpark. We have floating point instructions. If you thought the UltraSpark was doing a lot of stuff in parallel, a lot of bit operations in parallel before, just wait till you see what it does with floating point numbers. Let me start with a definition of floating point numbers. These are a very small subset of the set of real numbers. There's several different versions of floating point. I'm going to focus on what we'll need for good performance on the UltraSpark, which is called double precision floating point numbers. Floating point, you're supposed to be thinking, well, an integer is 31, and a fixed point number might be dollars and cents. You're always working with multiples of 0.01. A floating point number, you get any power of 10 times the number. There's no requirement that it be just 0.01 like pennies. Double precision is saying exactly how long your numbers are, how many bits you have in your numbers. All right, what are these numbers? Well, basically, I'm not going to give exactly the definition, but basically it is the set of numbers 2 to the a times b, which a and b are going to be integers, so this sounds like an integer, except a can be negative, so you can have 1/8, for example, 2 to the minus 3 times 1. And what are a and b? Well, where I'm being crude about the definition is that a, I'm going to say, is between minus 1,000 and 1,000, minus 1, 0, 1, etc., up to 1,000. Actually, there's a wider range of A's, and there's even some infinities in these, which I'm obviously not allowing when I say these are real numbers, but let's just take 2 to the minus 1,000 up through 2 to the 1,000 times, what is B? Here I'm going to be very careful about it. B is between minus 2 to the 53 and 2 to the 53. Let's say it starts at smallest is minus 2 to the 53 plus 1, and then minus 1, 0, 1, etc., up through 2 to the 53 minus 1. Of course, 2 to the 53 is also a floating point number, even though I didn't list it as b. If you take a as 0, 2 to the 0 times these b's, all the b's that I've listed are floating point numbers. But also 2 to the 53 is, because that's 2 to the a is 53 times b is 1. And similarly, 2 to the 53 plus 2, that's a floating point number, but 2 to the 53 plus 1 is not. 2 to the 53 plus 1 is not something you can write as a power of 2 times a b in this list. All right. The UltraSpark has lots of support for these floating point numbers, and yes, one more definition is that these A's and B's put together can be encoded in a fairly straightforward way, which I'm not going to write down the details of. It's a kind of side issue, although you do have to pay attention to it at a certain moment if you want to deal with floating point numbers. There's a definition called IEEE 754, IEEE Standard 754, which tells you how these floating point numbers can be put into memory, are put into memory. This defines an encoding from the set of floating point numbers, a one-to-one map to the set of byte strings, which I'll write as ZMod 256 to the 8th power. So floating point number fits into 64 bits, just like the integers that we've been putting into integer registers, all of which fit into 64 bits. The UltraSpark does not work with floating point numbers inside integer registers. Well, you can put them there, but to do arithmetic on them with the representation of with the A's and B's meaning certain real numbers and then doing approximate real arithmetic with those, you have to put the 64-bit quantities somewhere else, namely floating point registers, of which the UltraSpark has quite a few. The UltraSpark 3 has 32. I'm just going to abbreviate floating point as FP. Going to be writing that a whole lot, just like registers and instructions. FP regs. That's floating point registers. These have some stupid names, which are, okay, maybe the first one's not so stupid. Percent F0, if you accept that I0, percent I0 is a reasonable name for integers, then I suppose, for an integer register, I suppose F0, percent F0 is not so bad. But then the next one is not percent F1, it's percent F2. And then percent F4 and so on through percent F62. Which, when you get more into what the UltraSpark can do and how it looks physically, then you realize, okay, those are not such stupid names. But, well, if you're just learning about the UltraSpark and someone insists on using the traditional language for describing what it's doing, then you are faced with this missing F1, F3. Anyway, I'll try to avoid those names and just use C type notation for describing what's going on with these registers, but you should be aware of the limit on the number of these registers. There's 32 locations inside the UltraSpark 3 that store floating point numbers. They're just like the integer registers, but the operations you can do on them are different. These are storing 32 double precision floating point numbers. The UltraSpark has several operations on these registers. It can load them and store them from memory, just like the integer registers, and that's where it matters, the IEEE 754 encoding. If you want to put a number into a floating point register, if you have a number between 0 and a million, say, and you want to put it into a floating point register, you have to know how that 2 to the AB works, how it's encoded in memory, but that's a very infrequent operation. In cryptography, it's certainly part of the Pauli 1305 operation, but it's by no means the biggest part, so I won't worry about it too much. The UltraSpark has floating point load store instructions for these floating point registers, which in C notation you can write as, for instance, R is star double star S. This means take the location S, take the address of some spot in memory, some 8 bytes in memory, think of it as the address of an 8-byte floating point number, and then pick up those 8 bytes in memory, that's the first star there, copy it into R. And similarly, you can store numbers back into memory. The UltraSpark has all sorts of arithmetic, floating point arithmetic instructions. And I'm just going to list the critical three that you need, namely addition and subtraction, and here's the really exciting one, multiplication. F is G plus H, F is G minus H, or F is G times H. Now, the semantics here are not mod 2 to the 64, of course. They're something involving the meaning of these pairs AD, the contents of the registers, as real numbers. What does F equals G plus H mean? What it means is you're supposed to compute the closest floating point number to the sum of G and H. That's, wow, big ball on the screensaver. I will get to the computer pretty soon now. Stay awake there. F equals G plus H means, all right, you take G and H and you add them. And just like for integers, the result gets bigger and bigger if you keep doing more additions, and you can't possibly expect to fit exactly the result into a single register. What happens for integers is you take the result mod 2 to the 64, throw away the high bits. For floating point numbers, you throw away the low bits. You compute G plus H and round it to a floating point number. You compute the closest floating point number. Sometimes there are two, in which case you round to even. You compute one of the closest floating point numbers, F, to the sum of G and H. And similarly, F equals G minus H means you subtract H from G and then round that to the nearest or one of the nearest floating point numbers. F equals G times H multiplies G by H and rounds that to a nearby floating point number. I have a couple of examples here. Let's suppose that G is 7.125. That's a floating point number. It's 1/8 of something, 1/8 of some integer in the right range. This is, let's say, 2 to the minus 3 times 8 times 7 sounds like 56 plus 1. 2 to the minus 3 times 57, and sure enough, that is of the form 2 to the a times b, where a is between minus 1,000 and 1,000, and b is between minus plus and minus 2 to the 53. All right, let's suppose we have h being 2 to the 52 plus 2 to the 51, which is also a floating point number. Then what is F? Well, G plus H is 2 to the 52 plus 2 to the 51 plus 2 to the minus 3 times 57. And we have to round that. Maybe I should say first, G plus H is equal to 2 to the 52 plus 2 to the 51 plus 2 to the minus 3 times 57 plus is 7.125. And that's not a floating point number. So what does F come out to be? F is equal to 2 to the 52 plus 2 to the 51 plus 7. That's the closest floating point number to the result. You can hope to get, like, how about 7.5? Actually, that's farther away, and it's also not a floating point number. If you try to get any closer to the 7.125, you see the floating point numbers are this 2 to the 52 plus 2 to the 51 plus 7 and plus 8 and plus 9. Those are the nearby floating point numbers, and the 7 is the closest. You could also imagine, instead of 2 to the 52, it's important that this 52 is close to the 53-bit precision for the calculation I just did. If I had much smaller numbers here, then I could get this floating point number, because I could have a 2 to the minus 3 times something. This G plus H is exactly 2 to the minus 3 times 2 to the 55 plus 2 to the 54 plus 57. But that expression doesn't fit my 2 to the A times B, because the B there is too big. If you double this 2 to the 52 plus blah, 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 then you're above the top limit for B. The closest floating point number is this one, 2 to the 52 plus 2 to the 51 plus 7. The 0.125 has been thrown away. This has been rounded to 53 bits of precision. All of this rounding is much easier to do if I wrote the numbers in binary, except I'd have 53 bits to write on the blackboard, and that would be kind of painful. If I did that, I'd have the first 53 bits here and then have thrown away the 001 at the end. All right, had another example in mind, but I've forgotten what it was. Had it in mind, and now it's on the notes. Yes, suppose that H is twice as big. Suppose you have the same G, and suppose you have H being 2 to the 53 plus 2 to the 52. Then what is F in this case? Just H, 2 to the 53 plus 2 to the 52. I don't know. That's not the closest floating point number. that somebody can think of one closer. Certainly, yeah, it's in the right ballpark. Plus 5 is certainly closer than this, but it's not a floating point number because it's too big. If I wrote plus 5 here, that would be too big to be in the B range for A equals 0. And then if I tried having, bigger A doesn't work because it's not an even number, and a smaller A wouldn't work because it'd still be outside the B range. So the 2 to the A has to be a power of 2 to answer one question. Plus 8, okay, that's definitely closer. And this one is a floating point number. Let me write it in proper floating point form. You could write it. There's several ways to write it. And one of the IEEE 754 details is clamping down on the A and B, making them unique by something like requiring B to be at least 2 to the 52. But ignoring that encoding detail, we can write this as 2 to the 1 times something that is in the right range for B, namely 2 to the 52 plus 2 to the 51 plus 4. Or you could write it as 2 cubed times something. But this is certainly, this expression demonstrates that F is a floating point number. And it is very close to H plus G, where G is 7 point something, H is 2 to the 53 plus 2 to the 52. And if you look for some floating point number closer, you easily prove that, no, there isn't anything. This is the closest one. You can't get plus 7 anymore because that is not a floating point number. You can't get plus 6. Actually, you could get plus 6, but it's further away. That's the nearest, second nearest floating point number to the sum here. Okay. Was that in on my list of floating point examples? Let's see here. Yes, it was. Okay, so let me tell you how fast these instructions are. Before I do that, is everybody okay on the semantics? Go ahead. Oh, there are the instructions that we refer to as the unmentionables, the mole X instruction, for example, which someone might have told you will multiply integers modulo 2 to the 64. And they might even be right, but they're fundamentally wrong because what we are interested in this course is high-speed computation, and mole X definitely does not multiply at high speed. It is the slowest multiplication circuit I have ever seen. The fact that it exists in the UltraSpark is an embarrassment to Sun. You could, if you like, write R equals S times T, where S and T are 64-bit floating point integers, and get S times T mod 2 to the 64 eventually, someday, tomorrow. You don't actually want to do that. When I talk about the floating point multiplication, then you'll see that that actually runs at a reasonable speed. I would rather not talk about the speed of the multiply step and multiply X and so on instructions that the UltraSpark supports simply for the convenience of people who don't care about writing high-speed software. So the answer to your question is yes, but let's just hide that under the rug. It's not something you want to use for state-of-the-art cryptographic software. Okay, more questions about floating point or other buried UltraSpark instructions or... Okay, I still have to tell you about the speed of these instructions, and I think I'll jump into that. So, floating point speed. We have our major issues so far. There's been the computation throughput and the computation latency, and I have to address both of those for floating point. There's also load latency. I'll do an example putting all these together. After I've described the general picture, the floating point throughput and latency are as follows. Let's start with integer addition and subtraction. There is inside the UltraSpark 3 has one floating point addition unit. There were two integer additions, so it seems kind of unfair. Oh, well. The UltraSpark 3 has one floating point add unit, one FP add, or F add, sometimes they say, unit. And this unit can do, at best, if you give it the work to do, it will do for you, one floating point addition or one floating point, maybe I should say, first each cycle, it can do one floating point add or one floating point subtract. And as usual, by referring to a unit that can carry out certain operations and not mentioning any others, I'm implicitly saying this is the only unit that can handle these operations. the number of cycles you need for a sequence of floating point add and subtract instructions is the number of cycles that this unit takes for them, which is the number of floating point additions plus the number of floating point subtractions. There's another lower bound on the number of cycles. And again, it's very important to compute these lower bounds. If you're trying to analyze how much room there is for improvement in your current algorithm, then you should count the lower bounds for that algorithm. And if the lower bounds are close to your current speed, then there's not much room for improvement unless you can reduce the number of, in this case, floating point additions and subtractions. The latency for these operations is considerably worse than the latency for integer operations. There is a 4-cycle latency for floating point additions and floating point subtractions, which means that if you start a floating point operation on cycle n, you don't get back the result until cycle n plus 4. And that means that if you want to keep the floating point adder busy, if you want to give it lots of work to do, then you have to keep feeding it with 4 different operations. You need 4 parallel floating point additions, separate inputs that aren't waiting for each other, to keep the floating point adder busy. The floating point addition unit, or some combination of additions and subtractions. We'll see a detailed example of this later. What's happening inside the floating point adder is that along with doing an addition, one cycle addition, it has to think about the exponents, has to think about the a's, and then it has to round the result to the nearest number, and putting all that together ends up taking 4 cycles just to do a simple addition. It's considerably slower than an integer addition, mod 2 to the 64, because of all the extra work for rounding and exponents. On the other hand, you can start, if you have another addition to do, you can start that on the second cycle, because inside the floating point adder, there's a pipeline of the first part of it looks at the exponents, and the second part of it looks at the b's and does some addition there, and the third part does a rounding, and so on. And when the first part has finished one addition, which takes one cycle for that part, then it can accept a new input. And it's passed along the first addition to the next stage in the adder, and then you can have as many as 4 additions active simultaneously in different parts of the addition unit. That's why the throughput and latency look different here, is that you can have different pieces of the unit, a whole pipeline. People often draw complicated pictures of the pipeline with this feeding into that, feeding into that, feeding into that, and after 4 cycles of different pieces of the unit operating, you eventually get your answer back. But all we're going to need to understand performance is the fact that every cycle you can do a new floating point addition, but you don't get the result back until 4 cycles later. So you have to have 4 independent parallel additions to do if you want to keep this unit busy. All right. What else is there to say about addition? I do have one example here, but it occurs to me this example is totally subsumed by what I'm going to be showing you on the computer, so I'll just skip it. Let me get to what's really amazing about the UltraSpark and about pretty much every other popular chip out there, which is the floating point multiplier. The UltraSpark 3 has, for handling the floating point multiplications, which are the exciting, interesting new part of the list here of instructions, there is, along with the additions, a multiplier unit, 1 floating point multiplication unit. And this floating point multiplication unit can, each cycle, handle a floating point multiplication. This can, each cycle, do 1 floating point multiplication. This is something really impressive. Wow! The UltraSpark can do a floating point multiplication every cycle. Let's think for a moment about what's involved in multiplying floating point numbers, even ignoring the exponents that just have to be added, and ignoring the rounding that has to happen at the end. there's some 53-bit numbers, B and another B, that get multiplied together. And that's a lot of bits, times a lot of bits. If you were doing that by hand, how much is a 53-bit number in decimal? It's something like 15 digits. If you multiply a 15-digit number by a 15-digit number, you're doing like 200-digit multiplication, each of which is a separate bit operation. And each digit multiplication is many bit operations. If you do 53 bits times 53 bits in the most efficient ways that people know about, it's well over 1,000 bit operations. This is every cycle doing that for one floating point multiplication. This is multiplying 53 bits times 53 bits every which way. Maybe not with the quadratic time algorithm. Actually, as far as I know, that is what the UltraSpark uses, is multiplies every bit together and then goes adding up the results. There are somewhat better algorithms, but in any case, it's a huge number of bit operations. And at the end, rounding to 53 bits. This is a total of thousands of bit operations. Every CPU cycle. Which is, say, 600 million times a second for the original UltraSpark 3. That's a ton of work compared to the few hundred bit operations you can imagine for a 64-bit addition. This is a whole order of magnitude more effort to multiply numbers. Even though it's just 53 bits instead of 64, it's a really impressive circuit here. I admit that the picture I'm about to draw is going to be a slight exaggeration, but it should give you a good idea of what you should do to use the UltraSpark for serious computing. Here is, once again, the UltraSpark chip, life size. I had in the corner of it before an addition unit and another addition unit and some registers, and then the integer execution units have not just add but add and subtract, which maybe are merged, and then a less shifting, and maybe there's a little bit more stuff up there, the floating point registers. And then there is the floating point multiplier unit. Okay, it's not quite that big. Actually, the floating point multiplier is not such a large percentage of the chip. I haven't looked at a picture of the UltraSpark chip layout. I don't know what percentage of the area is in the floating point multiplier, but it's a lot. And if you think about it as dominating the performance of the chip, you will make reasonable decisions about how to improve your software for the UltraSpark. Similar comments apply to most other chips, like, say, the Pentium 3, the Pentium 4. If you want the UltraSpark to stay busy, you must keep the floating point multiplier busy. Tweaking little bits here and there inside the integer execution units and leaving the floating point multiplier idle is just wasting almost all of the computation resources you have available. Using the floating point multiplier, floating point multiplication unit heavily is critical. For high speed. If you use the floating point multiplier and you keep it busy, then you've got a lot of bit operations happening in parallel working for you. If you don't, you have a much smaller, much cheaper chip which is doing your work for you, which is maybe the best you can do if you can't think of any way to use the floating point multiplier. But keep in mind, you've got this massive resource sitting there willing to do thousands of bit operations every cycle. We're talking about something like 10 to the 12th bit operations per second. All right. What does this tell us about doing actual floating point computations? Well, I've got three little slides here, three little pieces of blackboard to say some other comments before I get into my example on the computer. I do want to say the latency for a floating point multiplication, which you could imagine being pretty big, that you'd have to have lots of floating point multiplications going on at once. But actually, this multiplication unit is very parallel. It does as much as it can in parallel, and it gets its results back in the same four cycles as the adder. The floating point multiplication latency is only four cycles. And I should have said before this, you have a lower bound here on the number of cycles you're taking if you count the number of floating point multiplications, although what I've been emphasizing is the upper bound that, wow, this is quite a lot of speed you can get. But I should mention the lower bound, of course, the number of cycles is greater than or equal to the number of cycles taken by the floating point multiplier, which is the number of floating point multiplications. All right, the latency of each of these is four cycles, and I have a feeling I have something else to say about these. And, just to remind you what the four-cycle latency means, this is if you start a floating point multiplication at cycle n, then it finishes computing its output, the rounded product, the closest floating point number to the product of the two inputs, finishes computing the product at the beginning of cycle n plus 4. If you have another instruction waiting for the result, then it will proceed. That next instruction will proceed starting at cycle n plus 4, if there's no other bottlenecks. All of these numbers, like 4-cycle latency and exactly even how many bits there are in floating point numbers, there's some variation between machines, and I figured this was a good moment to stick in a comment about the machine variability. Example of a different CPU. I'm not going to try to do a survey of CPUs. Again, I'm just going to focus on a few, this teaching tool, and then I'll show you what's different about, say, the Pentium 3. But the UltraSpark 2 is very, very similar to the UltraSpark 3. So this is not a typo. I've got an UltraSpark 2 now. It has almost exactly the same design, slight differences here and there. And one of the most noticeable differences is that it has a smaller latency for the multiplier and for the adder. It has 3-cycle floating point latency, which means if you have a chain of 1,000 floating point operations, each one depending on the previous one, it'll take 4,000 cycles on the UltraSpark 3 and 3,000 cycles on the UltraSpark 2. 2,000 cycles on the UltraSpark 1? No, it doesn't work that way. The 1 is a lot like the 2. As you vary your CPUs, you see all sorts of little differences like this, which demand slightly different sequences of instructions for top performance, but to a large extent you can write one sequence of instructions that does well on, say, all of the UltraSparks and one that does well on a lot of Pentiums, etc. Okay. What board should I switch to next? I should move this one up. This one down. And now I have a few comments. What comments do I have? A few other examples of what will affect the performance of your software. And then I want to jump into a serious example and then talk about Pauli 1305, how you use these floating point operations to do fast integer multiplication of bigger integers than fit into your registers. But let me first do some more bottlenecks, more slowdowns, things that might be making your sequence of instructions take more cycles than you would initially expect from the important bottlenecks that I've identified. What do I have on my list here? Yes, the instruction starting unit. Every instruction, whether it's integer, floating point, load, store, whatever, has to pass through an instruction starting unit, which is a little post office responsible for saying, hey, that's a floating point instruction, it should go over here, are the inputs ready? Decisions like that. This unit is capable of handling at most 4 instructions per cycle. At most 4 instructions per cycle. limiting all types of instructions. I've mentioned that you could do two integer instructions in a cycle, and I've mentioned floating point. You could do a floating point addition every cycle, and a multiplication every cycle, and you could do a load every cycle. And that sounds like five. But the instruction starting unit can't keep up with that. It can only look at four instructions, parcel out four instructions every cycle, which gives you another bound on the number of cycles. It's at least the number of instructions, all instructions, divided by four. Furthermore, the instruction starting unit has some little annoyances. These are the sort of things that if you know that these kinds of things exist, then you can figure out why a sequence of instructions is taking longer than you initially expected. The fourth instruction in a cycle cannot be an integer instruction. The fourth instruction cannot be an integer instruction, or a load, or a store. Of the instructions I've mentioned, it has to be a floating point instruction, or it could be a branch, a go-to. That also could be the fourth instruction. If you're aware that there's this kind of complication in your chip, which if I were designing a teaching tool, I wouldn't have this kind of limitation in it, but okay, the UltraSpark 3, all the UltraSparks do have this limitation, and if you know that this kind of thing can show up, then if you see some weird behavior for a sequence of instructions, then you have some idea where to look in the complete UltraSpark definition, that there must be some restriction on the fourth instruction or the number of instructions per cycle. Look for that section of the documentation, and hopefully it'll tell you this rule or whatever other rule you're bumping into. Same for whatever chip, if you bump into some weird behavior, this is just an example of the kind of weirdness that you might encounter. What was next on my list? Yes, the UltraSpark is an in-order chip. This unit, the instruction starting unit, starts instructions in order. And what do I mean by in order? I mean the same order that you provided the instructions. There's some sequence of instructions that you give to the CPU. Your program is a sequence of instructions. And those instructions will not be permuted in terms of their starting time. If you have an instruction I and an instruction J, then the starting time for instruction I cannot be later than the starting time for instruction J. The I start cycle is less than or equal to the J start cycle. There's other chips where this is not true, where there's some way to reorder instructions. Most current chips, in fact, are out of order and don't have this restriction. Another example of a restriction that you might see is the load store unit, which does its loads, finishes its loads in order. And this is last on my list of random slowdowns. The load store unit finishes its loads in order. So what does this mean? Suppose you have two loads that you want to do, and one of them is slow, and the next one is fast. The slow one will delay the fast one. Suppose that you have memory bracket S is in level 1 cache, and memory bracket T is only in level 2 cache. You remember what I said about latencies. If you load memory bracket S, then you'll get the result 2 cycles later. And then you can 2 cycles later add it to something, do whatever operation with it. And then if you load memory bracket T, it'll be delayed by 12 cycles from cycle 1 when you start loading it. You'll get the result back at cycle 13. These numbers like 12 are also the sorts of things that vary even between one UltraSpark 3 and another UltraSpark 3 depending on the clock speed. You get different numbers of cycles for your load latencies from different levels of cache and RAM. But anyway, if you load the fast one and then load the slow one, there's no problem. But suppose you do the other way. Suppose you pick up memory bracket T, which let me use the pointer notation for this. If you say R equals memory at location, the 1 byte of memory at location T, and then you pick up the 1 byte at memory location S, if you have these instructions, then what happens? Well, cycle 0, you'll have the start of the first load. And it'll finish when? Well, memory bracket T is not in level 1 cache, so you have to wait 12 cycles until you get the result back. It'll finish at cycle 12. And then how about loading S? Well, that'll start in cycle 1. The load store unit can start one load every cycle. Basically, every unit starts one operation per cycle. And the load store unit, there's one of them, so each load happens starts in a new cycle. Does this finish two cycles later because S is in level 1 cache? No, it doesn't, because there's this extra slowdown that the load store unit gets confused if some load comes back before it's heard about the previous load. So it delays the processing of this load and doesn't finish it until cycle 13, just as if S were not in cache. So if you do a sequence of loads, then it's important to get the cached ones first, otherwise you end up slowing everything down. This is my last example of a random slowdown. If you want to hear more about exactly, you want to see the complete definition of UltraSpark 3 cycles, then you should look at the UltraSpark 3 manual. As long as you pay attention to here are lower bounds and here are upper bounds, and then how close are they together, then you can tell if there's something happening that you don't know about. If all of the lower bounds, if your model of how the UltraSpark 3 works, if your simplified definition of the UltraSpark 3 is not consistent with your measurements of the UltraSpark 3, imagining that you have one, then you end up with concluding that there must be something else you don't know about, and then you know you have to look at the manual and figure out what that slowdown could be. All right, I have an example, and I have 35 minutes. My example is multiplying 100 numbers together. Cycle counting example. We're going to figure out, we're going to analyze with constant factors the speed of multiplying a bunch of numbers, specifically 100 numbers, together. The input here is 100 numbers, which I'll label as x0, x1, etc. through x99, each of which is a floating point number. Typical size of computation in that it easily fits into level 1 cache, and I'll look at the speeds when these are in level 1 cache, but it certainly does not all fit into registers. There are only 32 floating point registers. That 32 is another example of the sort of thing that varies from one CPU to another. The output here is the product. Well, I'm not trying to do multi-precision arithmetic here. Let me just say something close to the product of these numbers, a good approximation. 2, the product x0, x1, etc. through x99. While we're doing this analysis, I want to emphasize the three most important bottlenecks, which are the computation throughput, and here you can see the computation throughput says this has to take at least 99 cycles if you're doing floating point multiplications, then the computation latency and the load latency. If you look at, first of all, the computation throughput, presumably for doing as much work as a multiplication of two numbers, you want to use the floating point multiplier, and let's just assume that for our initial analysis of how fast we can hope this would be. Assuming that we do 99 floating point multiplications to multiply these 100 numbers, assuming 99 floating point multiplications, we have to take at least 99 cycles. Why? Because the multiplications are handled by the floating point multiplier unit, which does, at most, one per cycle. It has to take 99 cycles. But in fact, if you do a simple implementation, you find that the product is taking much more time to compute. Let me phrase this as questions, first of all, is both for analysis and for improving the algorithm, is what about the computation latency? That's a big type of bottleneck number two. And what about the load latency, which is big bottleneck number three? Looks like middle board here is not falling down too quickly, so let me try using the space under it. This won't be dangerous. Stop. Please stop. It's still moving. It stopped. Oh, that's an interesting idea. Does the second eraser... But I don't see where to squeeze it that it would actually lock the board into place. Well, all right, let me just pray that I have some space here. I suppose I'm not running really short on context here, so it won't be too bad if I use another board, but I feel like this board deserves to be erased and replaced with some software. So, what do I have here? My simplest example of how you would do this computation, the most straightforward algorithm, is simply pick up x0, most straightforward, that's supposed to be straightforward, algorithm. Let me just express this in C, which I think there's the maximum familiarity with here. I'll call this function prod100 for the product of 100 numbers. The input is an array of, 100 numbers. If you want this to be compatible between C and C++, you should make sure to say double star X there instead of bracket or bracket 100. But anyway, let's write this in C. You're given an array X, and you pick up the first element of X and put it in some double precision variable, which I'll call result, is X bracket 0, and then multiply it by X bracket 1, and multiply the result of that by x bracket 2, take the first result, x bracket 0, times equals, so result equals result times, the new result equals the old result times x bracket 1, and then the new result is the old result times x bracket 2, and so on, continuing down to x bracket 99, and then return that result back to the caller. Close break. All right, well, I tried typing this into the computer, and now we get to see, I want to clarify that my laptop here, named Atlas, high speed is the course information account here, and yeah, apologies to those of you on the right, my computer is not an UltraSpark. However, I have access to an UltraSpark if the network works, which it wasn't earlier today, but maybe, uh-oh. Oh, no. Well, I am prepared to write all the stuff on the board if there's no connection. And for the moment, it seems we have no connection. Well, it was worth a try. Sorry? Oh, there's an actual Ethernet cable. Hey. Okay, but I'm going to be typing enough. Let me just run away. Ooh, wait, there it is. Okay, I actually succeeded in logging in. Okay. Whew. All right, success. So, inside this directory, I did a very simplest implementation first, where I just did a loop. I said, what you can see here is the same prod 100 interface, and I started with result equals 1 multiplied by all the x's. I had a variable I, which counted from 0 up to 100, 0 through 99, and at each step multiplied result equals result times x bracket I, and then returned the result. And then expanded that into what I've written on the board, which is, let's see here. I hope that's exactly what I wrote on the board. Result is x bracket 0, and then result is result times x bracket 1, and continuing on and on, down to 99. My laptop beeps quietly, return result. And, all right, so there was some software. And then I timed it. And let me show you what the timing loop looks like. This is a standard looking C program where I've got, okay, standard definition of main, and now some variable I for loop counters, and I made some random data. My data bracket I. Interestingly, the UltraSpark, like the eCrypt website, seems to have a big gray square in it. Well, alright, my data bracket I, you can still read, thankfully, is random, which is a standard C function to return a not very random number between 0 and 2 to the 31 minus 1, as I recall. Then that gets multiplied by 0.001, that's 10 to the minus 9. So typically this is somewhere around 1 or 2, or somewhere in between. And then, maybe more often, closer to 1, what's the maximum? 2 to the 31 sounds to me like 2 billion. And then multiplied by 10 to the minus 9. So the 1 plus something times random is between 1 and 3? Maybe. I could look at exactly what random returns and check. I didn't even look at the my data results, but it's some positive real numbers, which we're going to multiply together. My data 0 through my data 99. And then I called this prod 100 on the same data repeatedly. Why did I do it repeatedly? Well, there's differences in the timings. What I computed here is before I called this prod 100 function on my data, I wrote down the time. And here's a CPU cycles function, which is not a standard function, but I'll tell you tomorrow as part of timing things how to install the CPU cycles. Actually, you can look on the eCrypt eBats webpage for the CPU cycles webpage, and that will say the four lines you have to type to install this on whatever computer. You get cpucycles.h, which is included up at the top, the third line from the top, and the cpucycles.o, which is linked with this, and then put the result of CPU cycles into start times bracket 0 before the first call, start times bracket 1 for the next call, and so on. What is CPU cycles returning? It's returning the number of cycles since boot. The machine starts and then instantly starts counting from 0, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And every program can look, whenever you feel like it, actually pretty efficiently, you can look at how much time it's been since boot. And that gets put into start times bracket 0, and then results bracket 0, just for double checking, is the product of those 100 numbers. And then back to the top, start times bracket 1 is the new cycle count since boot. So subtracting those, as I'll do in a moment, get the time for the first call, the prod 100, and then results bracket 1 is the next call, and start times bracket 2 is after that call, and so on. After these 10 timing loops print out 9 numbers, namely the differences between start times 1 minus start times 0 is the number of cycles spent inside that loop the first time around, most of which is spent inside the prod 100 function. All right, I compiled these together and came out with something like, well, here's a new run of it, something like the following numbers. The first numbers here on every line are the results bracket I, and those are all, that's the product of the 100 numbers, and maybe there's some explanation of why it's something around this that should probably tell you what the distribution of random is and then do some appropriate integrals. Anyway, that was the product of 100 numbers, and then in this column, 3,000 and 422, 422, 422, etc., that is the number of cycles spent. 3159, maybe I should have printed out, maybe I will print out the start times along with the, I can quickly modify this, let me print out along with the difference there, the number of cycles spent in the loop, let me show you those absolute clocks, the start times, oops, left out a T there, times bracket I. All right, and you can see I have a few different versions here. And all right, it seems that this machine has been awake for a very large number of clock cycles, but it's doing, this is actually a 900 megahertz UltraSpark 3, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, it looks like it's been awake for something like 5 million seconds. And there's 100,000 seconds in a day, so it's been awake for a couple months. All right, and then that's the number of cycles it's been awake, and then 3223 is the difference of that and the next number, which is how long it's been awake at the start of the next loop. And then it suddenly stabilizes down at 422. What's the reason for the difference? Why is it so much slower for the first loop? Why did the first call, the prod 100, take 3,000 cycles instead of the 400 for the next call? Cache. Yeah, generalized explanation for any sort of slowdown the first time you do something, and also an example of the dramatic slowdown you can get. 3,000 cycles is a lot slower than 400. Is that because of the instruction cache, the data cache? Well, I didn't measure. And if I were writing a typical speed paper, then I wouldn't bother measuring. Because here's the nice stable numbers that I can explain, something a little more than 400. Instead of, remember what our lower bound was, assuming we do this with floating point multiplications, as all of my examples of how to do this computation did, it should be about 100 cycles. That's what we can hope for anyway. Obviously, if we're spending 400-something cycles, with a little bit of instability here, which I might get into when I talk about cache timing attacks, if we're taking typically 400 cycles, once the data's all been touched, it must be in level 1 cache, surely, and then the presumably this is 400 cycles for 4 cycles for each multiplication, and then 22 more cycles for the CPU cycles call and the function call takes a little time, and the loop with I, that could maybe add up to 22 cycles. Why is this 400 something? This is far more than 99 cycles. It's more like 4 times 99 cycles. At least that's what the 400, maybe it's 3 times 99. It's really not as bad as 5 times 99, but we have the prod 100 call and a little bit of extra work to save results in the call the CPU cycles function. It's taking 422 cycles. Maybe I could add lines and do 150 or 200 numbers instead of 100, and that would give me an idea of how much more work every extra multiplication is taking. Why is it 4? And well, I have a graph which is the graph you should be drawing when you look at the sequence of instructions, which immediately explains the 4. And the answer is simply floating point multiplication latency. And here's the picture. Well, what is this sequence of instructions doing? It's taking x0 and x1 and then multiplying them together. When are they multiplied together? Well, starting on cycle 0, we have x0 and x1. And we can multiply them. And then cycle 4, we finish that multiplication. And then that result is multiplied by x2. The output not being available until cycle 8. The floating point multiplier has to wait on the second multiplication until it has the input. And then it can start on multiplying by x2 and finishes that 4 cycles later, cycle 8. And then multiply by x3, which happens on cycle 12. And so on. Assuming that these are all not just in level 1 cache, but in registers, I'm ignoring all the other times and just looking at the floating point multiplication latency bottleneck, that if x0 and x1 are ready on cycle 0, then at best we'll get their product on cycle 4, and then multiplying by x2, we get a result by cycle 8, and so on. All right, where am I in terms of blackboards? I think I should move this one up, erase the last little bit of what are we looking at, countably generated, must be box spaces continued. All right, any ideas for improving the sequence of instructions? Yeah, multiply 4 numbers together in chunks. Try to arrange doing 4 multiplications at the same time of independent data. Try to somehow rebalance this tree so that you have more work being done at the top. We have x0 and x1 available, and x2 and x3 are available at the beginning. We could start multiplying those and then multiply those results together. You could actually have a complete balance tree if you like. But yeah, the idea of doing 4 at one time is exactly what I tried next. Actually, before I go on to that, let me also show you with a little loop of I's. The first example that I showed you was a loop. Let me also show you the code. If you have, instead of writing straight line code from top to bottom of result equals this, and then result times equals that, result times equals that, if you do this straight line, well, there's one extra multiplication there because I started with 1 instead of x bracket 0, but that doesn't account for the 500-something versus 400-something. There must be an extra cycle disappearing because of the loop here, the manipulations of I that go to the top of the loop, which are instructions I haven't talked about. Normally, those will be the first things you eliminate in writing high-speed cryptographic software, is most of your instructions will not be keeping track of where you are in a loop. So not too worried about that 500 performance. Anyway, the next thing I tried was exactly what you suggested, which is clearly much faster because it has more instructions on every line. Result 0, okay, there's four variables here. Result 0, 1, 2, 3. And I'm trying to keep the multiplier busy. I'm thinking of it as four separate multipliers, which in some sense it is. There are four chunks to it. In any case, the latency throughput ratio for the floating point multiplication unit is 4. If we want to keep it busy, we have to have 4 operations happening, 4 floating point multiplications happening in parallel. So let me write this. The important features on the board here are we try to parallelize. One of the things that I like about looking at UltraSpark cycles from an academic perspective, and similarly looking at Pentium 3 cycles and other real-world computers, as opposed to looking at bit operations, is you get some sense for doing things in parallel and taking advantage of a, in this case, four-way parallel computer. There are much larger parallel computers out there, which you might try to take advantage of, and this is a first attempt to do that, and somehow studying CPU cycles gives you a hint of what bigger parallelizations are like. So here we have, I'm not going to recopy the software if you like. Maybe I'll just do one line, except I realize I'm going to be doing that in a moment for the analysis of the speed of this one. The important feature of this is that we have a much more balanced graph. We have x0 and x1 coming in at the top and then being multiplied by what's happening with result 0. Result 0 is taking x0 and multiplying it by x4. And then that's getting multiplied by x8, which is getting multiplied by x12. Just looking at the first column in the sequence of instructions here, you can see every fourth x is being multiplied exactly the same way as before, which happens in parallel with the x1 and x2 and x3 and so on are multiplied by their x5, x6, x7. The x1, x5 multiplication can start on, let me be careful here, assuming x0, x4 start on cycle 0, then x1, x5 can start being multiplied on cycle 1. And then x0, x4 is finished on cycle 4, passing through the multiplier, and x1, x5 product is finished on cycle 5. And then x0, x4 product is multiplied by x8, finishing on cycle, starting on cycle 5, finishing on cycle 8, and then x1, x5 is multiplied by x9, finishing on cycle 9. And then on the side, there's x2 and x6, which are multiplied together, starting on cycle 2, ending on cycle 6. And then last part of the picture is x3 and x7, which are finished being multiplied on cycle 7. So we've kept the multiplier busy, and then back to the beginning, back to the first of these four parallel computations, dot, 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 dot. Each of these trees is continuing down. There are four of these trees in parallel, and then back to cycle 8 in the first tree, cycle 9 in the second tree, and so on. At the very bottom, these trees are merged somehow, and is that on the screen? I guess it just fell off the bottom of the screen. Simply taking the four results and multiplying them together in some reasonable way, taking 0 times 1 and 2 times 3 and then 0 times the resulting 2 and returning result 0, there's the product of all of these numbers. And I tried this out, hoping to get a 4 times speed up. And I did get some speed up. So what am I looking at here? I guess this has been recompiled for the printing out the absolute time and then the differences in those times. Instead of 420-something, we now have 320-something, with, again, a couple of burps there. And, again, the order of magnitude slowdown for the first-time operation. You really have to be afraid of cache misses if you're trying to make sure you have consistently good performance. But, okay, just focusing on the in-cache performance, 326 cycles. We have, instead of 4 times 99, and instead of the 99 we're hoping for with this beautiful pattern, we get something like 3 times 99 cycles. Not 3.99, sorry, 3 times 99 cycles. Which again triggers the question of why? What is the sequence of instructions doing that's taking all of this time? Any ideas? I'm sorry? Level one cache needs two cycles to fetch the data. Exactly. What's happening here is we're being delayed by load latency. There's the 99 cycles for the floating point multiplier, and, well, okay, let's look at exactly what's going on with this sequence of instructions. What's going on is that the multiplication there does not magically get the x bracket 96 into a register. It's, in fact, not even a machine instruction. What I've written in C here, what I've said, for instance, let me take a typical example here. I guess I've lost off the top, but something like R0 times equals x bracket 4. This is not a machine instruction. It's two instructions. It's a load and a multiply, which have to happen in order, and the next one also has to, okay, let's go through exactly what's happening here. R0 times equals x bracket 4 is not a CPU instruction. The C compiler converts it into a sequence of two instructions. Namely, first it picks up x bracket 4 and gives it some new name, finds a register for it, %06. Well, you're not allowed to use %06. %04, all right, let's just say x4 is x bracket 4. That's a load instruction. To be precise, x bracket 4 is star, double star, with some parentheses in there, x plus 32. The 32 being that x bracket 4 in C is actually, maybe I should write this down, this is star, double star, and then in parens, x plus 32. Because x bracket 0 is actually stored at the x location in memory, and x bracket 1 is stored 8 bytes later, and then x bracket 2 is stored 16 bytes later, and this x bracket 4 is 32 bytes later. So the C compiler produces that, i.e. this, and then it multiplies it into R0. How long does this take? Well, we're going to look at it in context, but to see the big slow down here. When you load x4 is x bracket 4, that has to wait for a couple of cycles, and then a couple of cycles later, you get R0 times that result. That can start. And then there's another load. Oops, I realize that what I've written here is not what the C compiler produces. Sorry. Instead of writing x bracket 4 there, what I meant was x4. So R0 and x4 here are supposed to be register names, and then X4 is copied from memory, loaded from memory, and then R0 is the new R0, is the old R0 times X4. Question? Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay, so magnifying glass says, all right, the first machine instruction is, X4 is star, double star, X plus 32. You take the integer x, it's an integer location, the number of bytes in memory before x starts, and then add 32 to that, you get the location where x bracket 4 starts, view that as a double precision floating point number location, pick up that double precision floating point number, in other words, pick up memory bracket x plus 32 through x plus 39, and then use the IEEE 754 standard to decide what that means in x4. Actually, X4 is just a bit-by-bit copy of the memory, and then in doing the operations, it decides what those bits mean. And then R0 is set to, I could do it as new R0 equals is the usual coding convention of what sounds mathematically strange. Of course, this means the new R0 is the old R0 times the current X4. Or you can write R0 times equals X4 in a proper assembly language if you like. In a traditional assembly language, I don't even want to think what these instructions would look like, but okay, I hope this level of explanation of what the instructions are is comprehensible. All right, let me look at the big picture and see what we can conclude about the speed here. Where am I in terms of boards? I think it's time to move this one up. This one down and figure out where that 3 is coming from. All right, what happens here? So we pick up, let me start from the top of the code. All right, we pick up x bracket 0. Result 0, let me just call this R0 for the board, is x bracket 0. That load happens on cycle 0. I'll do start and finish times for each of the instructions. R0 is x bracket 0. This starts on cycle 2. It finishes on starts on cycle 0, finishes on cycle 2. And then similarly, we pick up x1, x2, x3. And load throughput is demanding that those start on subsequent cycles, cycles 1, 2, and 3. And they finish on cycles 3, 4, and 5. And then we load x bracket 4. Result 0, R0 times equals x bracket 4 on the third long line in the code there. That's saying pick up x bracket 4. That's the example I just did. X4, new variable name, is x bracket 4. And that starts on cycle 4, finishes on cycle 6. And then R0 times equals X4. This can't start before cycle 6. And then it'll finish on cycle 10, which won't be a bottleneck for us. And the reason for this 6 is that there's a dependency. And if you draw the graph here, you get, well, the R0 is waiting for that X4, and the X4 copied from X bracket 4 is delayed by throughput is delaying the X4 load here, and then the instruction, so maybe I should draw the graph in a minute and you'll see what this is like. The throughput is forcing the load to wait here until 4. Latency of the load is forcing a delay till 6. Then waiting for the input for the next instruction is forcing a delay of the start of that one until 6. And then the next instruction is delayed by the UltraSPARC being an in-order chip that when we load X5 equals X bracket 5, you would think that would start on cycle 6 and then finish on cycle 8. And then continuing in this way, you would expect that there would be 2 cycles per line. Why is it 3 instead of 2? Well, why 3 and not 2? And at this point, you look in the manual and you say, wait a minute, I must not be knowing something about the UltraSPARC, and you realize floating point loads are delayed by a cycle. Floating point loads are delayed. And this is just another example of the more you get into a chip, the more you realize, okay, it's important to read the complete definition at some point. If you see something that's strange, like you expect that, hey, this should be every 2 cycles you start a new load and a new multiply, and it actually seems to be 3 cycles per, we were getting 300-something, then look in the manual and see what it is that's causing your slowdown. All right, I decided I was not happy with 2 or 300 cycle performance, so the final speed up here is to separate. Oh, yes, I was going to add a graph for you, which, sorry, I didn't draw before, but let me see if I can do it on the fly. We've got a load of R0, and then we've got another load, which is starting on cycle 1. And then we've got another load of R2. What we're seeing here, these delays are the load throughput that the load store unit is only able to handle one new load every cycle. Normally, this won't be a bottleneck. Normally, high-speed cryptography is not dominated by loads or stores because it'll fit most of what's happening into registers for most of the time, so don't worry too much about load throughput. But in this case, at least at the beginning, there's this delay. And then we get the X bracket 4 load, which is one more load throughput delay, and then we start being delayed by something completely different. After the X4 load, there is a delay of 2 cycles. This is supposed to be length 2. And that's a delay from what? It's a delay from the load latency for X4. That is load latency. And then there's also a non-tight edge, which is going all the way from R0's load down to the let me be careful here, down to, this is producing the output of the load, which is then fed into a multiplication, which, yeah, starts right here. This is R0 times equals X4. These are the starting times for the instructions. R0 was starting up there. X4 is the delay. The tight edges here are there and there, and I have to do one more edge at the bottom of the picture, which is the X5 equals X bracket 5. In other words, the X5 load. And that is a zero cycle delay, but it's still, maybe I'll do it horizontally for a zero cycle delay. X5 equals X bracket 5. That is the next instruction in the program, and it's being delayed by the instruction starting being in order. Okay, and then this continues. The pattern after this is there's this load, this is the X5 load, and then two cycles later another multiplication, and then zero cycles later another load, except, oops, it's not actually two, it's three, because of the floating point loads being delayed by a cycle. Okay. I still have a little bit of time. Yeah? Well, that changes. The load here takes two cycles, but then an extra cycle to wend its way over to the floating point unit. The load actually gets to the integer registers, and then, actually, I don't know what happens physically, but my mental model is the load gets to the integer registers, and then they say, wait, we don't want this, this should be over in the floating point unit. And then there's an extra cycle for sending the load result over to the floating point unit. Yeah, so the two should actually be three. And so, okay, what changes in the picture is the following. Because this is a floating point load, this should actually be 7. And this should actually be 7. And this should actually be 11. And this should actually be 7. And this should actually be 9. And then in this picture, similarly, maybe the graph, it's more clear what's going on. It's just the 2 here changing to a 3. Should not be an X4. What is it that? Well, okay, you can model it either way. X4 is a floating point number, and for actually copying the floating point data into this floating point register, there is a delay of a cycle. It could actually be that well, I can imagine lots of physical models for what's going on, but the simplest way to think about it is that when you're loading a floating point number, like this X bracket 4, then it actually has an extra cycle of latency. And the same for loading from level 2 cache. Think of it as you're doing the load. Okay, if you think of it the way I said a moment ago, if you do the load and it finishes two cycles later, and then, oops, there's an extra cycle to get to the floating point unit, then that would say that, yeah, it's 4 to 6 and 6 to 7. What's important is when the floating point multiplication starts, which is three cycles after the load instead of two cycles. Whichever model you have, I would suggest what my Spark simulators do is a plus 3 for the finish and then... I'm sorry?